You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Hi, hello, welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, baby, and I am that host of yours, she who loves a good chat about nerdy shit, Liv. Now you might be thinking, why is this episode out on a Thursday instead of a Friday? Or now you're thinking, I don't know what you're talking about. It's Sunday, Liv. Like, it doesn't matter. Anyway, either way, today's episode is coming early to make room for a very special project that's going to drop tomorrow. Today, I am joined by returning guest, Dr. Jeremy Swist, who knows all things about the Emperor Julian. That's right, Rome, but kind of not. Never heard of Julian? Yeah, I hadn't really either, because he comes after Constantine, and in my head, that's the time when I stop caring. Because Christianity. I'm sorry, but I'm not actually. But no, it turns out Julian was the one emperor who wasn't keen on old Jesus, and tried to bring the empire back to its pagan roots. Needless to say, that didn't work, but we still have some of his work. And he's interesting. Today's episode looks at what this work of Julian is all about. This specific work. The Symposium of the Caesars. Sometimes called the handful of other things. We will get to that. And Jeremy has put together a full cast recording of his new translation of that work, which is what's coming tomorrow. A full cast dramatic reading of this work by Julian. It is so fun. And if you listened to Tuesday's episode, you got an idea of what that is. I put in like about a minute, I think it is, of this recording because it is just so much fun and I want to get you all pumped. But today's episode is a conversation looking at what this work of Julian is all about. But as a sneak peek, just to get you intrigued, I will just say now that it is a conversation amongst dead leaders of the ancient world and Greek gods, and things get heated and weird. It's incredibly fun. But Jeremy and I today talk about translating that work and then the project itself, the casting and intention behind it. It's a long-standing idea and project that is finally being realized, and I am lucky enough to be bringing it all to you tomorrow. Jeremy and I had a great time talking about this, and the piece itself Oh, it's just so fun and different. Like, you are going to love it. So here is my conversation with Jeremy, and you can find the Symposium of the Caesars, a full cast dramatic reading, in your podcast feeds tomorrow. Conversations. A bunch of rulers sit down for a chat. Julian's Symposium with Dr. Jeremy Swist. So yeah, like, let's just dive right in. Like, we talked about this last year over Chinese food in Victoria when we first met in person, which was just so fun. And then now it exists. So I love, like, I'm going to tell the listeners a reminder of, like, you literally were like, so I have this idea about recording my own translation of something. And I was like, I love when people translate something and then give it to me to use, because I can't just, like, use any translation. And that's always my hurdle. So you were just like, gave me such a thrill of information. But then also, I knew absolutely nothing about this myth source. Like, I was about to, like, make some claims as if I understand, but basically what I do know is that Julian is not only Roman, but so late in antiquity that he's so far beyond my usual interest realm that I just had no idea. And then you told me all these things and I was like, well, this sounds incredible. So why don't you give us, maybe start with, like, who the hell Julian is?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Julian was a Roman emperor who reigned only a very short time as, you know, full sole Augustus, about 20 months from 361 to 363 CE. Though he had also been a junior emperor, subordinate emperor called a Caesar since 355, kind of subordinate to his cousin, Constantius II, who in turn was the son of the Emperor Constantine I, who reigned a much longer and before that, and who was known as the first emperor to promote Christianity as a favored religion of the empire. And so, and his sons, Constantius II especially, who succeeded him, also took part in that project of favoring Christianity, promoting Christianity at the expense of traditional Roman pagan religion. And what happens is that when Julian succeeds Constantius II as emperor, Julian, in fact, kind of comes out and says, oh, by the way, I am no longer Christian. You know, at some point when he was in probably his early 20s, he encountered in his education a number of Neoplatonic philosophers and a specific school of Platonism that actually rejected and saw itself as incompatible with Christianity, and saw that Christianity was actually a threat to essentially the fabric of the cosmos, because they saw a traditional Greek and Roman religion as actually a way of making sure that society functions, you know, with kind of order and peace, and people become virtuous through their piety toward the gods. And in return, the gods will, you know, grant victory to the Romans, will make sure that, you know, the crops grow, peace, and there's peace and prosperity. And they saw Christianity as not a traditional religion. It was, you know, this kind of new coming religion that they didn't even worship gods. They worshiped some man who died, you know, and they saw it just had no connection to kind of the traditional religions and rituals that the gods themselves had, you know, prescribed through oracles and other forms of revelation, you know, way back in furthest antiquity. And so Julian undertakes a program of trying to kind of dial things back, to bring back and restore and favor the cults of Greece and Rome and other, you know, native traditions throughout the empire. which he saw as all essentially compatible under one sort of grander philosophical view. And he saw Christianity as not something that was actually could be compatible with that.
Okay, sorry. I want to hear everything, but I also just have to step back and be like, one, this is like all I knew about him was that he was like pagan amongst Christianity and thus interesting to me. But also I just have to say that describing Christianity as a threat to the cosmos is like so relevant. Like I mean, there's it's not irrelevant even today, I would argue. And I love it. So thank you. That's why Julian is certainly interesting. So I do want to hear about what he did like other than that. But I am very much more interested in the whole like saying no to Christianity and apparently failing at it. But I love that he tried.
Yeah. And, you know, there's lots of questions about, you know, whether his program of, you know, the restoration of traditional religion, you know, would have been successful. The thing is that he died in battle against the Persians, you know, 20 months into his reign and happened to be succeeded by emperors who were Christian. And so the Christian emperors that succeeded him just kind of picked up where, you know, Julian's predecessors left off and went toward, you know, further Christianizing and favoring Christianity in the empire till it became more or less the tradition, the official religion later on. And it seems that Julian's kind of programs, you know, did have support while he was alive. You just needed an emperor, you know, in power who would continue to sustain it. Because even when he was emperor, you know, the majority of people in the empire were not Christian. So who knows?
We could have had a different life.
it's one of those what ifs of history that I am not, you know, that we scholars are not do not address because that's science fiction. But you know, it's just,
I can dream.
He just reigned too short for us to be able to say whether his policies would have failed or not.
Yeah.
You know, he also had various military, you know, shortcomings that you know, got things into some problems as well. And the whole fact that he kind of initiated this war against Persia, you know, could have been seen as sort of symptomatic of, you know, some of his shortcomings. You know, he didn't necessarily have to, you know, fight against Persia, though part of the logic was to kind of prove that, you know, if we worship the traditional gods, they will give us victory. And so if he did come back alive from Persia victorious, you know, that would have kind of validated, you know, his whole program. But he happened to die, you know, in a skirmish, in fact, while they were kind of going back from Persia. So that's just kind of a chance event. But anyway, Julian was much more than just, you know, as I said, a very religiously minded person who had this religious policy. That's what a lot of people tend to focus on when they think about him or study him. That's very important, but I'm also very interested in many other sides of him. He's a very multifaceted, complex figure. And, you know, in addition to a religious thinker and a philosophical thinker, he was also a very literary minded person. He saw himself as a scholar and someone who was very interested in not only reading various works of literature, poetry, prose, history, oratory, satire. He also saw himself as, you know, a representative of what they call paideia, which was, you know, not only the education that was based on reading the Greek classics like Homer, the playwrights, Demosthenes, Thucydides, etc., okay, but also one who produces that kind of literature themselves. So we actually still have from Julian a number of all sorts of works of Greek literature. We have plenty of speeches that he wrote. We also have lots of letters he wrote, and, you know, letter writing even was its own sort of art form back then. And we also have, you know, hymns to the gods that he wrote. He apparently wrote a bunch of poetry that we no longer have. And he also wrote some what has been called satires. One of probably the more well-known one is called the Misopogon, because which is literally means the beard hater, because Julian was known for growing a beard, which was contrary to what the other emperors in his dynasty had done since Constantine. Constantine, you know, represented himself as clean shaven. He wanted to look kind of like Apollo, like the Emperor Augustus. And Julian, you know, he grew a beard in order to show that he is associated with, you know, traditional Greek philosophy and intellectualism. But also, you know, you could also say that he wants to identify with his, with the rank and file soldiers as well. So he's sort of like Hadrian, where he's kind of playing it both ways with, you know, he has a very soldierly profile as well as a very scholarly profile as well. You know, he wanted to be everything to everyone for the most part. And so the Mesopicon was essentially a kind of this big screed that he wrote, making fun of himself, but also making fun of the people of the city of Antioch that he just with whom he just didn't get along. he kind of went to the city of Antioch toward the end of his reign as kind of a jumping off point to go fight the Persians. And he brought his army in and he was really trying to undertake all of these, you know, pro-pagan reforms. And the thing is, the city was majority Christian. And so there was a lot of resistance to that. There was some, and so he basically just wrote this big speech, you know, just, you know, it's an example of, I think, an emperor who, you know, he didn't want to like retaliate against all of these citizens who made fun of him, like in any violent way. He was just like, okay, if you're going to insult me, I'll just insult you back. Right. So it's all good fun.
I love the idea, though, of just like not getting along with a city. Like, there are very few people, I think, who can be like, yeah, well, you know, I just really didn't get along with this city. I'm going to write about it.
Well, yeah. And, you know, this is not an uncommon thing when an emperor visits a city, you know.
I mean, yeah, their empire was so big. How do you? Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you're there. You got all your army there, the whole administration, and you're dealing with people all the time. It's like, imagine like, you know, like when Taylor Swift comes to town, or like when the Super Bowl is in your city, or the Olympics, or like the World Cup final or whatever. You know, a lot of the people living there are going to be annoyed by all of this stuff going on. It's kind of a disruption of your everyday life. And so, and the city of Antioch especially was notorious for, you know, not getting along with emperors who would visit there. You know, it wasn't just Julian, but anyway, he also wrote another satire, or at least it's called a satire, probably during the same time that he was in Antioch. And it is what you would call a dialogue, at least initially. And because it starts off as a two-way kind of conversation between Julian and an unnamed companion. A hetairos in Greek. And the title of this dialogue, satire, whatever you want to call it, is actually a matter of debate, because in the manuscripts that we get from the late Byzantine period, we have the title saying that this was either called the Symposion, right, or the Chronia. And the Chronia, ta Chronia, is Greek, the Greek equivalent of the festival of the Saturnalia, okay, the festival of Cronus, Chronia, right, Saturnalia, Saturn, right? And so it was thought that this was, and the beginning of the dialogue makes this clear, that the occasion for the composition and maybe even delivery of this work was mid-December during the Saturnalia festival. And it's uncertain whether it would have been in 362 when he was in Antioch, or at the very beginning of his reign in Constantinople, where he entered the city shortly after his predecessor passed away. More likely, he probably wrote it in 362 in Antioch, but I won't get into that.
I just have to have reveal a moment, yeah, where I realize that I am so ill prepared for like Christian times of the Roman Empire that I forgot that Constantinople would have even been a place where they would have reigned. Or I'm like, oh right, you can just tell where my historical tendencies lie. I mean, they don't even go to Rome at all, so yep. I'm not surprised. But I love this. I especially love when these things come up that are like so far beyond my usual interest. But I'm like, oh right, like Constantinople existed. It's almost like, obviously, if someone came after Constantine, like that it would have.
Yeah. And the fun thing is that, you know, it was Julian's uncle Constantine that said he founded Constantinople, but what he really did was there was the city of Byzantium.
Yeah. Right?
It was an ancient Greek city going all the way back to the archaic period. It was there all through classical times, and it was, you know, a major port city all through, you know, the Greek and Roman period. And just what Constantine did is he sort of embellished it and established it as a new imperial capital named after himself, that he planned to be, you know, a second Rome, a new Rome of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's during this time and during kind of Constantius's, the second's reign, that Constantinople really starts to rise in status to be almost a rival to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony is that Julian was technically the first Roman emperor to be born in Constantinople, because Constantinople was officially, quote unquote, refounded in 330 CE. Julian was born in 331.
Wow. Well, and here I'm thinking first, like, oh, Antioch is so far from Rome. Like, there's no wonder they don't like them. And I'm like, oh, wait, Antioch is not that far from Constantinople, though, comparatively.
It's a bit closer.
Yeah.
But the thing is that even though Rome is not a place where emperors tend to visit much, it's still a very important city. It's still seen as the actual capital and spiritual center of the empire. Mm-hmm. In fact, what Julian is doing in his reign is, if you read his writings, he actually says a lot of nice things about Rome. And he thinks that he's very committed to the idea that the city of Rome is the true capital. And that the Romans themselves are destined by the gods to rule the world. And what happened is that before the Romans came, the gods themselves prepared the world for Roman rule by sending out Greek colonies through the Oracle of Apollo, right? You go to the Oracle not just to get your prophecy about, you know, that Oedipus got and what, but a big function of the oracles was, hey, we need to go found a colony somewhere. Where's a good place? And so the oracle would say, oh, there's this nice territory, you know, in southern France or something you can go to. And so as a result of the Greeks colonizing, you know, the oikoumene, the inhabited world as they conceived of it, that was a spread of Greek civilization, of Greek culture, of Greek values. And so that when the Romans came along to establish law and order, these places were already ready to receive Roman rule.
Mm-hmm.
And so Julian talks about that a lot. Just getting back to the topic at hand.
Yeah.
So this was called in the manuscripts the Symposium or the Chronia. However, we have sources from centuries earlier that refer to this work as the Caesares, right? As the Caesars. And so it's uncertain whether what title Julian gave it, if he gave it a title at all. And so what I decided to do when I approached this work to translate it, I'm just like, let's just have it both ways. Let's call it the Symposium of the Caesars. The reason I start with that and I start with this conversation between an anonymous Hetairos companion is that's exactly how the Symposium of Plato begins, right? It starts with this guy named Apollodorus talking to an anonymous Hetairos about what Aristodemus told him about a party that happened at Agathon's house after he won a tragic poetry competition, and Socrates showed up, and they essentially had a contest of, you know, who's going to give the best speech defining Eros, the god love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems that Julian is cueing us to say that Plato's Symposium should be a model for kind of the plot of the Caesars or the Symposium of the Caesars. Because what ends up happening is this is Julian telling his companion about a banquet of the gods, a symposium of the gods up in kind of the heavenly Olympus. In which there is a series of speeches in a contest, seemingly over, you know, who was the best ruler, who was the best emperor, right? And the thing is that whereas, you know, Aristodemus told Apollodorus about Agathon's party, it is actually the god Hermes himself who tells Julian about this story
on Olympus. I love it.
Right. And the interesting thing is that, you know, you can understand that in various ways. So Hermes is the god of literature.
So to clarify first, so is he using Greek? He's using the Greek gods?
Right. So Julian was actually born in the Greek speaking part of the empire, right? In around Thrace and Bithynia, around Constantinople, right?
Right.
And he was raised primarily as a Greek speaker.
Okay.
He learned Latin later, especially when he got into being emperor and stuff. But primarily the language of his literary production is Greek.
Love that. Okay.
The fact that Hermes, or at least he represents Hermes as telling him this myth, you know, Hermes is the god of literature, prose literature especially. And also Hermes is, you know, represents sort of a conduit between the wisdom of the gods and humanity communicated through literature, right? And well, what is inspiring Julian to write this myth? Well, Julian is reading a lot of Roman history and a lot of other literature in order to inform him about, you know, the participants in this banquet of the gods at which the souls of the dearly departed Roman emperors actually come up and they dine with the gods, and then that's the and then they have this contest. So when Julian is telling his companion that Hermes is his source for this information, he actually says, well, Hermes says that I'm not sure whether Hermes, you know, was telling me the truth or he was making things up or there's some mixture of truth and fiction in what he told me. And how I see that is, well, that sounds a lot like what Hesiod says at the beginning of the Theogony, right? Where he's like, you know, the muses, you know, I was on Helicon, the muses showed up and said, we're going to tell you lots of cool stuff. We can tell lies, we can tell truth, and I guess it's up to you to tell, to determine what it is. And so that's sort of what we're working with here. And I think another reason he is mentioning that is, when Julian is telling a myth, you know, part of it is invented, right? This is not, he's not retelling a myth that was received from the tradition, like, you know, the playwrights of Athens would have done, or the Homeric bards would have done, right? Or Pindar or whatever. He is making up a myth from whole cloth, just like Plato did, right? And that's why at the beginning of the conversation with his companion, they talk about how Plato himself told myths, he invented myths, but he told myths that nevertheless had truth or something, you know, some kind of lesson within them. And so I think what Julian's doing is he's saying, I made up this myth. However, it contains a lot that is true. Okay? And it's up to the audience to decide, right, how should we interpret this? In other words, this is an allegory.
Okay?
And Julian, and this is not the only place in Julian's surviving works of literature where he talks about, you know, the production of myths. He makes up myths and tells about how to read them as allegories. What is the myth about?
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. T-I-K-A.com.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva, also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
As I mentioned before, there is a banquet of the gods on Olympus, though when he says Olympus, he also means like up in the heavens. Mm-hmm. There's that whole thing of like, it's not the actual mountain, but like they're up in the sky because these gods are being identified with the planets. And so they're all up in the sky where their planetary, you know, manifestations are.
Oh, I love that.
And the occasion for throwing this party is the Saturnalia. It is a party in honor of Cronus, right? And the master of ceremonies for this is Romulus, the mythical founder of Rome. And he is there as some form of god in his own right, because according to Roman mythology, Romulus, after he was born of Mars and founded Rome and had this illustrious career as the first king of Rome, he then, according to some accounts, mysteriously disappeared and then later appeared to a guy named Proculus saying, by the way, I have reascended to the gods from which I descended as a god, and so I'm going to be, should worship me now as the god Quirinus. And in fact, after that initial introduction, he is referred to as Quirinus for the rest of the dialogue. And so Quirinus decides, Romulus Quirinus, however you want to call him, decides, in honor of this party, we are going to invite all of the Roman emperors.
It's such a fun idea.
Whoever lived, right? And yeah. What he means by the Roman emperors is all of the souls of the emperors who had died. So they come in one by one, starting with Julius Caesar. Okay, he calls them the Caesars so that you can count Julius Caesar as well.
Convenient.
So starting with Julius Caesar, okay, Octavian, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius Nero, etc. They all come in one by one in chronological order of when they reigned.
Yeah.
Right? And some of the emperors that come in or attempt to come in don't actually make it all the way to where they're having the party, because they were bad emperors. So for instance, Caligula and Nero and Commodus and all of these and Domitian and all of these other
suspects,
the notoriously, you know, tyrannical emperors actually get thrown out. A lot of them get thrown into the underworld, to Tartarus, okay, to be among those like who are tortured and punished in the deepest pit of the underworld.
Yeah.
Right. But the emperors that do make it into the party happen to also be the emperors that the Roman Senate had deified, had actually voted on, saying, okay, this was a good emperor, so let's establish a hero cult for them and worship them as a god,
mm-hmm.
right? So one of the themes of the Symposium of the Caesars is deification. And what does it take to, you know, become a good enough emperor to earn, you know, deification. Like, what is true, you know, godhood, or how does one become properly like the gods? How do you imitate the gods in the proper way that you can eventually earn, you know, assent to communion with them, right? And so some of these bad emperors that come in, they are trying to imitate the gods in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So for instance, Nero comes in and, you know, somebody remarks, hey, Apollo, here's somebody who's trying to imitate you. And Apollo is like, yeah, he's trying to imitate me, but he's doing it completely badly, right? And so he throws him into Tartarus. Though what's also interesting is that Augustus comes in and he is also trying to imitate Apollo and Helios and the sun god. However, Apollo actually intervenes also for Octavian Augustus and sends a philosopher named Zeno of Kitium, the founder of Stoic philosophy, to go in and actually transmute and transform Octavian into gold. So, which is symbolic of philosophy saving Octavian from, you know, the fate of being thrown into Tartarus for being a tyrant, and he becomes, you know, a sensible and good ruler.
It's interesting because, like, I like that there's criticism of Octavian, but like not fully, obviously, like, you know.
Right.
But it's interesting to have that explicit kind of criticism of him.
So I won't go through all of the emperors that come in, but basically all the emperors up through Julian's immediate predecessors, Constantine, Constantius II, etc., come in,
mm-hmm.
right? So all the emperors are there, and then the gods decide, okay, we need to put these folks to the test. We need to see them prove that they are worthy of being in our presence. And coincidentally, Romulus/Quirinus actually was begging the gods, saying, could we take one of these emperors, one of these descendants of mine, and bring them up to dine with us? Because the emperors are actually at a lower level in kind of the celestial hierarchy. They are not true gods, right? And so they need to do something. They need to do something extra to be able to be worthy of actually ascending to where the gods are. And so I tend to think of this, and this is an analogy that I write about. You're at a family gathering, and it's a very large family gathering. And it's one of those where there's the adults table and then there's the kids table. The gods are sitting at the adults table. The emperors, they're sitting at the kids table.
Yeah.
And Romulus is the old grandfather who invites one of the kids at the kids table to come to the adults table as an honorary adult. And so they hold this contest to decide, okay, which of these kids is worthy of joining us at the big kids table, the adults table, as an honorary adult, as an honorary god for a day, right? As it were. Right, who gets to earn that triumph of dining with Jupiter on the Capitol, you know? So the gods decide, okay, let's hold a contest. And then the gods decide, oh, we're not just gonna like have every single emperor compete. We're only going to like have the limited set of contestants among those who already have the reputation for being the best emperors. And so they bring in Julius Caesar, Augustus, and Trajan, as well as Marcus Aurelius and Constantine. And at this point, Heracles, who is essentially Romulus's Greek equivalent of kind of a hero who, you know, became a god, right, says, well, why are we having a contest over the best ruler if the best ruler isn't even here? Where's Alexander the Great? my descendant.
Duh.
Right? And so they decide, okay, let's just bring Alexander in to this contest
He's like, who the fuck are all of you?
To try to see if any of these Romans, you know, is a match for this one Greek.
Poor Alexander, this is how he finds out that his legacy is, like, not as good as he wanted it to be.
Oh, certainly. There's a lot of discussion of that, right? Another thing to mention, before they actually have the contest itself, while the emperors are coming in, among the gods, there is somebody who has the most lines of this dialogue, if you will, is the satyr Silenus.
Hmm.
And he's kind of the Socrates figure in this. He's also kind of the comic relief. He's kind of the court jester at this whole entertainment, because all the emperors are coming in and Silenus is like making fun of them. Right.
I can only picture that like bust of Socrates where his nose is just like, he's just got this cute little button nose. And for some reason that it was like, oh, Silenus. And then Socrates immediately, I was like, oh no, I can see it. Yep. Yeah. I got that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he's just this kind of like buffoonish guy who's just taking all these cheap shots at these emperors coming in. And the thing is, one of the reasons that he is doing this is he's trying to make Dionysus laugh. Because Dionysus, basically, Silenus is in love with Dionysus, right?
Yep.
In fact, Silenus is represented as kind of an Erastes, you know, an older... person, the older member of a pederastic relationship, of which Dionysus is the Aromenos, he's the beloved, right? And then there's some thought that, you know, this is like the pretty young Agathon at Plato Symposium that Socrates is, you know, trying to impress.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can't have a symposium without a little Erastes Aromenos.
Exactly. and so Silenus is basically trying to, you know, to entertain and impress his beloved. So they finally are ready to have the contest. And so one by one, each of the candidates, the contestants, gives a speech to argue why they were the best ruler. And Julius Caesar speaks first. He talks about his great military record, though in the process, Julius Caesar is just as much kind of playing up his military achievements and how powerful he was, but at the same time, he is also dunking on Alexander. He's like, you know, oh, Alexander, you know, he wasn't all that great. I did things that were much more impressive.
Like got stabbed in the back.
Yeah. He's like, so for example, Julius Caesar was like, you know, I showed pardon to all of my enemies, right? I pardoned them, you know, eventually I got stabbed in the back for it, but at least I was a merciful, you know, just ruler, right? Look at Alexander. He didn't even spare his friends. Alexander comes in next. And basically Alexander is fucking pissed, right? He is just like, little twerp.
Yeah.
Thinks he was a match for me when in fact Julius Caesar was, you know, he doesn't even mention Caesar's name, right? Julius Caesar modeled himself on Alexander, right? It's like, how are you like, you know, you're taking your own idols and you're dragging them through the mud. It's like, and he goes on this whole thing about like, you know, you defeated Pompey, but Pompey wasn't all that great for all of these reasons. And so because your main rival wasn't all that great means that you weren't all that great. So there's a lot of this kind of military kind of show up one-upmanship.
Yeah. Who do they call Megalos? It's not Julius Caesar.
Right. Right. Octavian comes in next. Before Octavian can speak, Poseidon kind of intervenes and says, hey, wait a minute. Octavian gets a penalty for how much time he's allowed to speak because they're using a water clock. When the water runs out, you're done. And so Poseidon says, I'm going to pour out less water for you because...
I was going to ask why it was Poseidon, but now I get it. All right.
Right. Water. Exactly. Exactly. And the reason for that is Poseidon was still mad at Octavian for a remark he made that we actually read in Suetonius where, you know, Octavian was fighting against one of his rivals, Sextus Pompey, a son of Pompey in the civil wars. And he experienced various setbacks because he was trying to fight all these naval battles against Sextus, and Sextus was, you know, very much, you know, he was kind of a pirate.
I was going to say, you know, he was general. The pirate guy, right?
He was the
like
pirate
the only
guy.
Thing I know about
And so
him.
At one point, Octavian says, you know, I will defeat Sextus in spite of Neptune. And Neptune remembered that.
Yeah,
and so Octavian decides, okay, that was my bad. I have to give a speech that is short and to the point. And so he's like, I'm not going to bother bashing these other people like the other people just did to each other. I'm just going to talk about my own achievements. Next comes Trajan. Silenus specifically makes fun of him for having a drinking problem, but also for, you know, having... He's a bit too fond of young boys. So it's very interesting because during late antiquity, like, Trajan is thought of as like the Optimus Princeps, like the best emperor.
Yeah.
However, if you look at just some of the Greek sources, there's a little bit of discussion about, well, he also drank a lot and he seemed a bit too fond of young boys. Julian picks up on that and he runs with it to the point where Trajan, when he first comes in to the party, and you're going to love this, Silenus looks at Zeus and says, look out, Zeus. Don't let your precious Ganymede leave your sight. Because he knows that Trajan is, you know, might, you know, has an eye for that demographic, as it were.
Trajan was Hadrian's heir too, right?
Other way around.
Oh, okay. So still, somebody learned from somebody else.
Julian actually seems very opposed to, you know, emperors who have any reputation for sexual scandal.
Mm-hmm.
So he makes fun of Trajan for his pederasty, and then when Hadrian comes in, he also makes fun of him for that. So Silenus's remark against Trajan is, you know, why is this guy, you know, gazing at the heavens? Is he looking for Antinous?
And I mean, probably.
And the illusion here is that Hadrian deified his boyfriend, right? And he was expecting to find him up in the heavens when he himself was, you know, died and joined the party. But he wasn't there.
No, well, because, you know what? Antinous probably took that chance. He was like, get the fuck away from me, Hadrian.
Yeah, I'm sure Antinous was happy that he didn't have to spend eternity with, you know, trapped in that relationship.
For real.
As a lot of people sort of have seen it. So, who's next? Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, one of the only ones that for some reason I can recognize. I was in Rome recently and I was very proud about the fact that I could pull him out of a lineup.
he's got the beard, he's got the curly.
Yeah,
so a lot of people recognize that Marcus Aurelius because he was very much interested in philosophy, that he was seen as sort of somebody that Julian highly admired. He certainly did, though I wouldn't say that Julian absolutely idolizes Marcus Aurelius either. You know, he calls out some of Marcus's faults. Because the point of, I think one of the points Julian is making this dialogue is that here's all these emperors, including emperors that are traditionally seen as ideal models, like Trajan, like Marcus Aurelius, and even these ideal models have their shortcomings, right? And the true models that we should take to be not just good rulers, but being good people, is the gods themselves, right?
Sure.
And Marcus Aurelius also recognizes this, right? And the thing is, and one reason this is seen as kind of an allegory and everything, is in late antiquity, among especially kind of the philosophically educated pagans, people who believed in the traditional gods, but also, you know, had kind of different conceptions of how the gods were really like through their, you know, consumption of philosophy. They believed that the true Olympian gods were actually, you know, much more idealized. They were actually, you know, all-powerful beings, all-knowing beings, and perfectly morally good beings, right? Mm-hmm. But of course, how do you account for all of this literature within all of this mythology that represents the Olympians as very much not that, right? As, you know, committing all of these scandalous acts of being anthropomorphic in a sense, right? Having all these all too human limitations, you know, all the things that you, that your listeners are, your listeners are quite familiar with.
The reason I have my show.
Right, exactly. Right. So what people like Julian and people who engage with kind of these forms of really Platonic philosophy at the time is they say that, and the Stoics were doing this and others as well, they would say that the literature of people like Homer and Hesiod and others was not meant to be read literally. These were allegories, right? So they are meant to be interpreted as representing some deeper truth.
Just thinking of the weirdest myths and being like, okay.
So for example, the idea that Athena was born out of Zeus's skull and it got cracked open, right? That is an allegory for the fact that is that Athena represents the forethought of Zeus, and Zeus himself is the cosmic intelligence, right, that pervades the cosmos, right? The gods were not corporeal beings. They were beings purely of spirit and pure intelligence, right? And that the myths were essentially a way of using images as ways of kind of making sense of all of these kind of more abstract kind of processes, right? And so when Julian is presenting this myth where he's representing the gods dining at a banquet, right, he is understanding this as and representing this very much as an allegory. When it's time for Marcus Aurelius to give a speech, Marcus looks at the gods and he's like, what is the point of all of this? Why do we have to sit here, give speeches to tell the gods things they already know? Because Marcus knows that the gods, as, you know, the beings of pure minds, already know everything about him. And so he doesn't see it necessary that he has to compete in this contest, because he knows that whoever's going to win is going to win. Right? The conclusion is already destined, right? In the great plan of the gods, right? And so he basically says, you know, just judge me as you see fit, you know, whether I was a good ruler or not. And the gods responded well to that, actually. You know, they thought, you know, that's actually a good point. Okay. Finally, it's Constantine's turn. Now, the only reason Constantine is one of these elite in the contest is because when the gods were making the selections, you know, who would be the competitors, Dionysus actually chimed in and said, well, we have warriors, we have a philosopher, but we gods need completeness. We have perfection here. We need the whole picture, right? And so why don't we invite a lover of pleasure, right? A hedonist, add him to the mix, to kind of complete the picture of like all the various options for the type of ruler that we can evaluate here, right? And so Julian very much does not like Constantine, right? He believes that Constantine's introduction of Christianity basically completely threw every value, right, and every tradition on its head, right? He believed that Christianity was not a pious religion that encouraged morality, but quite the opposite. It was a religion that allowed you to be able to just indulge in all of your carnal pleasures, and then all you had to do was go to confession and confess your sins and do the holy water thing, and then you were fine, right? And he makes fun of that thing toward the very end. And so Constantine isn't even like interested in competing, because he saw what all these other emperors said about themselves, and he's like, I can't compete that with that. I'm sorry. Like, so he tries to say a few things for himself, like, oh, I overthrew some usurpers in civil war, right? You know, I had a pretty decent military record, but you know, it doesn't really stick. That's the end of the speeches. That's not the end of the contest, though, because the gods recognize that, you know, rhetoric and giving a speech and making yourself, you know, you know, look good and presenting your record is all well and good, but that's not really what we really need to do to evaluate these people. And so they decide, okay, we're going to have a Q&A session. We're going to have a question and answer round, and we're going to ask them all the same question. And that question is essentially, I phrase it kind of like Conan the Barbarian, what is best in life, right? In other words, what was kind of their core value that motivated them to do what they did? Well, anyway, I won't spoil the ending. Let's do it that way.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is an ending. There's a couple of surprise endings as to kind of what the result of the contest is, and sort of where kind of people end up after that.
Yeah.
But I won't spoil it. You'll see.
We have a whole production of it. It's so fun.
We have a whole production of it.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. TIKA.com.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant. Just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Yeah. Well, and I love that you just wanted to translate it, but then also, like, it lends itself so well to a whole production piece. So that's why I was so thrilled when you had the idea. But yeah, like, I mean, maybe just like the thought process behind like translating it, but then also, yeah, like why you wanted to make it a whole production other than it's just like great and interesting.
Yeah. So I have there's a number of reasons. First off, I saw in this work, there's really something for everybody,
mm-hmm.
right? If you're interested in Greek mythology, if you're interested in Roman history, if you're interested in ancient philosophy,
mm-hmm.
Rhetoric, ethics, like what does it mean to be a good ruler, a good person, right? What does it mean to become a god? There's all of those questions are in there. And I think mm-hmm. Julian's really kind of tying together a lot of different kind of strands of his thought because he himself is a Roman emperor, right? And he's using this work as kind of a meditation on, you know, what does it mean to be a good ruler, to be a good person? Like, where do I see myself, you know, in relation to all my predecessors as emperor?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what were some things that they accomplished that were admirable, but what were some of their shortcomings that I can try to avoid, right? What is the relationship between a proper ruler and the gods, right? So I think, you know, there's something that it's also very entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very funny. Right. But it also there's a lot of, I think, good lessons as well.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said too, that's, it's so interesting to have a work that is like, you know, so ancient to us, but is also intentionally interacting with something that is so ancient to it. You know, like he's so intentionally creating this piece that is like not a mirror, but like clearly inspired very heavily by Plato's Symposium. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then I think just to remind my listeners that like there's a good 700 or so years in between Plato and Julian. And like, I love to emphasize that kind of thing when we're talking about like the broad space of time that we have for antiquity. Like, you know, this is such an ancient work, but it is also interacting and navigating with an even more ancient work so intentionally. And like, what does it say, you know, that there's that 700 years in between? And I love, thinking about that aspect as well.
Yeah. So it's definitely, you know, a form of reception of Greek mythology, of philosophy, of history, you know, just as much as, you know, a modern adaptation, you know. So there was that. And I thought, okay, you know, I'd love to translate this, you know, in a way that makes it accessible to an audience, because I think a lot of people would be entertained by this, would have a lot to gain from it. How do I present that? Well, I could just write a translation and try to get it published to be read. And I still have some ideas of maybe doing that as like maybe a school text, for instance. But anyway, I thought, well, this is also a dialogue, right? You know, this could actually, and there is some thought that maybe it was actually performed as a dialogue. When Julian composed it, was this something that people just read, or was, did they actually dramatize this in some way? And one theory is that perhaps he produced it as a dramatic reading. Okay. In other words, we're not talking about a full production like Greek drama. We're doing something that some people say the tragedies of Seneca were presented as, where kind of people with the different parts would sit there and kind of read or recite their parts, but there isn't really any spectacle or anything. And the thing is that this is a thing that is done in my own experience, and the model for this, for kind of dramatic readings of ancient dialogues, was something that I experienced and then took part in as an undergraduate at the University of Maine. My first reading, quote unquote, of Plato's Symposium, well, I didn't actually read it. It was actually presented to me by various faculty members of the University of Maine honors program, playing different parts of characters in Plato's Symposium as what they called a reader's theater production. And so like the ancient philosophy professor, Michael Howard, played Socrates, for instance, or the guy who was the head of the drama, the theater department, played Aristophanes, right? So it's just, it was perfect. So that was kind of my model. And I thought, well, I don't want to just do this like in person, but now that we've had the pandemic and all of the things where a lot of these types of productions were then put online. So reading Greek tragedy online that the Center for Hellenic Studies did, or the Oedipus Project, right, that they had during the pandemic, where you essentially, that was, you had, you know, people who were performing Greek tragedy, but they were sitting there, you know, behind a Zoom camera, right? So that's another model that I had. And so I decided, okay, let's do it this way. I will translate this in order to be accessible to, you know, a contemporary audience. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to record each character, you know, as cast as somebody, right? And then I'm going to eventually put all those recordings together and have it produced, you know, through a podcast. And that's why I came to you, Liv, in the Chinese restaurant in Victoria, to pitch this to you, because I thought, you know, this is very much something that I think, I hope your audience will enjoy. And so that's the audience that I had in mind when I did the translation. Okay. The translation itself is not a word for word literal translation. I take a lot of creative liberties, you know, with kind of rearranging sentences grammatically, for instance. So it's not that kind of word for word literal translation. However, I try my best to be faithful to the sense of what it says in Greek. Mm-hmm. I do push things a bit with some anachronisms and everything, but again, it's in English. So of course, it's going to be anachronistic anyway. Yeah. I also turn this into a true dialogue. So if you read Plato's Symposium, you read Julian's Caesars, you'll see that most of it is Julian reporting what other people say.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what I did was I just made this a true dialogue where, you know, every time somebody says something, that's the actual character saying mm-hmm. it rather than Julian saying that they said it. Mm-hmm. Right. And in fact, there are parts in the Greek where you have what's called reported or indirect speech, where Julian says, you know, Zeus said that something. And I just made Zeus say it.
Right.
Just to get more people than Julian talking, because Julian is still the narrator and he still says a lot. But whenever somebody has direct speech, they're the ones speaking. What I also did was I threw in a lot more proper names than the original Greek state, partly just so the audience can better follow along, but also just because I think there's a lot of elusive allusion to like certain people. Like, for instance, you know, when Caligula comes in briefly, Caligula's not named, right? You know, Damnatio Memoriae, if you will.
Right.
He's just introduced as, you know, an evil monster, right? Eponeiron Therion. And I was just like, and in came an evil monster, Gaius Caligula, right? Just, you know, just to get that satisfaction, I guess. So stuff like that.
Do we need to remind my listeners that Caligula means little boots?
Yeah, here's the little boots. Right. And of course, Julian didn't even say his name, so he wouldn't have said anything about that.
But I think it adds something to say an evil monster. Gaius Little Boots.
Yeah, and so this is one thing where I'm departing from kind of what Julian's doing, is Julian wrote for an audience that he expected to be familiar with a lot of this stuff. And so he used a lot more allusion rather than stating explicitly, oh, this is Caligula I'm talking about. You know, I want to make this more accessible to an audience. And honestly, you know, I know a lot of people might have gotten the reference already, but, you know.
Well, it reminds me of, Greek myth, where so often you're hearing like an epithet or like, one of the names that's based on who their father is. And like, if you know, great. But like, they expect you to know. And sometimes it is very unclear if you're not familiar. So it's helpful to have that like extra detail.
Exactly. You know, like if I'm assigning translations for a class where like they're referring to Zeus as Cronides or the son of Cronus, and it's not actually explained who that is, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like it's unhelpful for most normal people who don't spend their entire lives in this stuff.
Exactly. So there's that priority. One of my favorite things about this whole project was deciding whom to cast.
Mm-hmm.
And because what I actually did was, I did a lot of the casting before I even finished the translation.
Yeah, you had a whole plan when we were talking. Remember, you had like goal casting. I imagine a lot of it panned out.
Right. And the reason of that is I wanted to translate the dialogue with that not only that character in mind, but that specific person that I cast.
Mm-hmm.
Right. People who I was kind of familiar with how they would have naturally sounded. Right. And I think that really helped doing it in that order. What decisions went into casting? Well, these were people who had some association either with the character or somebody who was familiar with, who works on Julian as an academic and was especially familiar with this particular writing of Julian. Right. So this was an opportunity for both scholars of Julian to kind of get their name out and to do something connected to things that they're interested in, just as I'm interested. But also, I wanted to other folks who actually have been on this podcast who have a connection to some of the mythological characters. So, for instance, you've spoken with Emma Polly about Dionysus. Mm-hmm. Emma Polly plays Dionysus.
Of course they do.
Right.
It's only right.
Okay. You have spoken to Meg Finlayson about Alexander. Meg Finlayson plays Alexander.
Yep.
Right. And so forth. Right. And then of course I also have people who have worked on Julian come in. So for instance, Trajan is played by fellow late antiquity scholar named Alberto Quiroga Puertas. He is from Spain. So is Trajan.
Amazing.
And so I present Trajan in this translation as someone who has a Spanish accent,
mm-hmm.
right? And when he uses proper names, he actually uses the Spanish version. So when he refers to Alexander, he says Alejandro, right?
Amazing.
And I did the same thing with Leia Nicolai, who is from Italy, and she just recently put out a book on Julian, which is really good. She plays Julius Caesar, okay, because I wanted an Italian to play Julius Caesar,
yeah.
because Julius Caesar's speech is very much, you know, Rome is the best, right? And so it worked very, I think that worked really well. And then finally, I was like, we can't do this without someone who's I can't have someone who isn't Greek be part of this. And so my good friend Marios Koutsoukos, right, who is also a scholar of late antiquity, Neoplatonic philosophy, etc., he plays Zeus.
Hell yes.
And so he does Zeus justice, I think.
Yeah.
And speaking of justice, you know, I also reached out to some other people in the Classics podcast community. So there are a couple minor characters, but Romulus himself, as well as there's actually a couple lines by DK, by Lady Justice.
Amazing.
Okay, because she kind of comes in and she kind of, you know, sorts out which emperors get to stay, which get to go. I got the partial historians.
I was waiting for them. I
right,
love it.
Right. So
just get some Australian in there.
So yeah. So Dr. G plays Quirinus, and Dr. Rad plays Justice. Yeah. And so, and then finally, one of the big stars is Silenus, who has the most lines other than Julian the narrator, whom I myself play.
Of course.
and Silenus is played by Chris Pult.
Okay? Oh.
He is a scholar of Roman comedy, Roman poetry, and he's he's a good actor,
mm-hmm.
right? And he especially nailed Silenus with the comic relief, as you'll see. So I selected all these people, you know, partly because they're just my connections in sort of through Classics Twitter or Classics X, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
right? And just thought this would be a fun kind of project for us all to be involved in. And I think they all took to it really well, because, again, these were characters that I think they had special connections with. So another example is my good friend Aniran Pendragon has a special connection to Hermes. That's sort of their patron god, and so they play Hermes.
Amazing.
And the reason for this is, you know, I wrote this dialogue, you know, with these people in mind, with this character in mind, but I also wanted their interpretation of the lines to be influenced by how they themselves kind of thought. Is this how would Alexander would have sounded, right? How would Hermes sound? How would Dionysus sound? How would Silenus sound? And they all had their own unique interpretations that I think that really made this work. So yeah, I spent basically last year kind of trying to get a lot of these recordings in person myself. For instance, you know, Chris Pult was running a Roman comedy workshop last summer, and that's what brought Emma Polly in. That's what brought Toph Marshall, who plays Apollo, in. So that was convenient.
Very recent guest on the show. I love it.
Right. I went up to Maine to meet with my old undergraduate mentor, Jay Bregman, to play Cronus. Also, I went to the UK last summer, and that's where I recorded with Leah for Caesar. That's where I recorded with Aniran for Hermes. And that's also where I've recorded with my good friend Charlotte Naylor Davis, who plays Constantine. And the reason I selected her as Constantine is because Charlotte is from the north of England. And Constantine, even though he is from like modern day Serbia, Constantine is known for being an emperor he became emperor in York, right? And there's that statue of him, you know, sitting with the sword, you know, outside of York Minster. That's very famous. And I thought, okay, I'm gonna make Constantine be a woman with a Yorkshire accent. think that would be fitting to kind of the character that Julian is trying to portray here. And she did a great job. Charlie was great, knew exactly what to do. Whereas Meg, who plays Alexander, is from the south of England. They put on a very kind of posh, like London, you know, southern English accent, because Alexander is very bratty in this.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, very entitled, right? And so it's like, how dare he, you know, compare his achievements to mine, right? It's you know, it just works so well. And Meg knew exactly what to do. It was great.
I love it.
Last but not least, who was
I had so many
the,
lines.
Who was cast as the Hetairos, who as Julian's anonymous companion at the start of the dialogue? Well,
that had
to be Liv Albert, because that's what what is the Symposium of the Caesars if not bringing Julian onto the Myth Baby podcast to talk about a myth that he learned from Hermes, right? Of course, somebody interested in myth is going to want to hear about that, right? And so just made sense.
Here to remind people that the masculine version of Hetairos is always translated as companion and the feminine version is always translated as prostitute. So I'm here for it being that word specifically too.
Right. I think companion is definitely much more accurate even in the feminine.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
You know,
it's sexism. It's patriarchy. Anyway,
exactly.
Sorry.
But anyway,
not. Yeah.
No, that's, you can have Rebecca Kennedy on to talk about that if you want.
I know, I've got her back already. Yeah.
Right. So once I had all the recordings, I also had the privilege of being the cousin of a wonderful human being named Christopher Swist. And my cousin Chris is a music professor. He's currently at Trinity College in Connecticut. And he is also an audio engineer. He built a recording studio at his home in New Hampshire. And his father, my Uncle Larry, was also an audio engineer, you know, who taught him, you know, everything there is to know about that stuff. And so, you know, this podcast production is in memory of my Uncle Larry, his father. So, you know, we'll do that little dedication. Anyway, Chris was more than happy to volunteer to mix and edit and master and work his magic to put all the recordings together and make it all sound, you know, doing all the things that I think, you know, you're used to doing as a podcaster with these
That's
recordings.
Being very kind to how much editing I put into this show, but yeah, sure.
Yeah. But yeah,
I know what I'm doing.
So I just lined up all the recordings in a row, gave him the script, and he was able to put it all together into a single file. And, you know, we had a lot of fun. I went up to his place this past winter in New Hampshire to kind of listen to some of the final edits and, you know, change a few things around. So, for instance, there's a toward the beginning of the recording, there's a couple places where Julian quotes Homer. And when he quotes Homer, we actually add a lot of reverb.
Hell
right.
Yeah.
Right. And actually, the inspiration for that is there was an audiobook of Stanley Lombardo's Iliad that I listened to from Audible several years ago. And what happens is whenever you have a simile in that recording and Lombardo himself is the narrator, they add a bunch of reverb. Right.
That's so helpful. Because you know, the similes are out of control,
right.
And also so necessary, but like sometimes you have trouble keeping track. I love that.
Right. Yeah, yeah, and so so that worked really well, and so now we have the recording and it's ready to be released, and I'm really excited for people to hear it. This was just a pet project of mine that I really wanted to get out of my system. It was kind of a creative piece to a book that I have been writing on Julian, in which I talk a lot about this particular work. I have a whole chapter devoted to an interpretation of it. And if you read the chapter along with the translation, you'll see kind of how those go together. But, you know, that book will probably come out about a year from now. Through Oxford University Press.
Amazing.
So that's I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, congratulations on that one too.
Thank you
so much.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be called Julian Augustus, Platonism, Myth, and the Refounding of Rome. And so there's a lot of discussion of how Julian approaches myth, uses myth, interprets myth, particularly Roman mythology, right? How does he look at, you know, myths of the founding and the founders of Rome, like Romulus, right? And how does he connect that to kind of his own identity as a Roman emperor, you know, but who is also somebody who is a scholar of philosophy, right? And how do those two things combine, right?
Well, I'm really excited about this production, and also just like the story being told itself, and like, yeah, I cannot wait to listen to it and air it on the show. I'm so excited for this, though. Thank you so much for like wanting to have it put on my podcast and like giving me this content, but also just like it means a lot that I get thought of for stuff like this, and I'm just so thrilled to like, you know, be able to help you put it out into the world. I think people are gonna really like it. It's such an interesting thing that it's like kind of goes under the radar.
Yeah. Thank you. And also just thank you for doing your part in this and supporting this. That creative energy I just wanted to get out of my system, especially like, you know, after having this very serious academic monograph. I do hope your listeners enjoy it, because I had tons of fun, you know, translating it, casting it, recording it, putting it all together, talking about it here with you. And so I hope you folks will enjoy it as well.
I'm sure the fun is going to come across. I've been wanting to do like some kind of production for so long, but like I can't ever put the time in just because of how much time I have on the podcast. So I love that you were able to basically do it all and then wanted it on my show. Like, I think, yeah, we both win. It's great.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, thank you so much for doing this. And yeah, I'm so thrilled.
My pleasure.
Man, who knew late antiquity and even the Christian period could be interesting? Not me, but I am sure glad to know more about Julian now. Thanks so much to Jeremy for coming on the show to talk about his favorite guy, but also this supremely fun translation and project that he has let me be a part of. I can't wait for you all to listen to this, reading this dramatic full cast recording. The casting is so well done, and it's just like a seriously fun concept. This conversation of gods and flawed men. What a time. So stay tuned for tomorrow's episode, which will be the reading of the Symposium of the Caesars. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, better known as the assistant producer. Laura Smith is now the production assistant and audio engineer. The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcast Network. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you will get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.